You've heard our open themes with listeners talking about their vocations.
Missouri dairy farmers, love issues, etc.
And what they're doing while listening to issues, etc.
This is Mark from Michigan, and I am a lawnmower listener. We love issues, etc.
We're looking for more of these elements to include in our open themes. Tell us about your vocation, hobby, or what you do while listening to Issues Etc. Call the Issues Etc. comment line 24/7 at 618-223-8382. If you make a mistake, just start over. 618-223-8382. Thanks for listening, and thanks for contributing to Issues Etc. 618-223-8382.
There appears to be a little fissure in the left among progressives or liberals. I don't even really know what to call the elites of academia who, well, up until about 10 years ago, were all for open debate, tolerance, disagreement among colleagues, and talking about ideas that they don't necessarily agree with. There are still a few of those. They signed a letter that will be published in Harper's Magazine. But the reaction from the other part of the left has been, well, pretty angry. We're going to talk about an open letter on cancel culture from liberal elites. Emily Jashinsky joins us. She's culture editor at The Federalist and author of a recent column titled The Harper's Letter Will Be a Bulwark or a Death Rattle. Emily, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us about this letter that is scheduled to appear in Harper's Magazine, published online, a letter on justice and open debate.
Right. It's very funny that this letter is explicitly an affirmation of, quote, open debate, because that in and of itself is a remarkable statement on how far academia and media has fallen, that it's even we're even at a point where open debate is controversial. And that's actually what this letter proved, because it turned into an event that really split the media into two camps. One camp that said it's important for us to support open debate, this letter is a good thing, and another camp that said this letter is reinforcing anti-transgender ideology and white supremacy. Its subtext is that those ideas, you know, is that we have to be able to debate people's identities and their truths and all of those things. Thus, it's unacceptable for us to affirm our commitment to open debate in this way. That is really what we saw happen. And just today, actually, there was a counter letter signed by a bunch of far left figures in mostly media. And there were a lot of people from major newsrooms that signed their names to this far left counter letter that said, you know, in theory, sure, open debate is great, but it actually espoused a very, very different definition of open debate, one that would preclude people from having open, that's a great word, conversations about things like transgenderism and, you know, sexual identity and all these really difficult issues. It's not an open debate if you can't have that conversation. And that's the type of open debate that the far left wants. And they are all over boardrooms and newsrooms and academia. That's really what this letter showed.
So why is the Harper letter perhaps a positive development?
Yeah, you know, I think it actually is positive. I think time will tell. But so far, only a couple of people have been pressured to drop their names from the list. It was about 150, it was a coalition of about 150 people from media and academia. And of that, only two of them dropped out. But it's a good thing, because the reality is we do have to affirm those ideas right now. The media, and like we were just talking about, the media and academia is full of people to whom the concept of open debate is controversial because they believe it perpetuates a system of bigotry in this country. And so it is actually incumbent on us to reinforce these ideas, no matter how silly it sounds, that a letter affirming a commitment to open debate would be bold or brave or necessary in the United States of America, but it is. And so I think the fact that you have these people. I mean, it's people from the far left. You have Gloria Steinem, you have Noam Chomsky, and you also have some people who would probably consider themselves to the right, like David Brooks. When you put all of those people together in a coalition, that is a statement. Those are powerful people. These are powerful people saying, we are going to do what we can to stop this, you know, rising tide of censoriousness from the far left. So just to get them on the record committed to that and to see it, it's a good thing. There's no doubt about it, because those people could easily go in the other direction.
So how do you account for the kind of hostile reaction from the radical left, and then, as you say, even their own counter letter? How do you account for that?
Yeah, it really comes out of, you know, I've been reading a lot of, for a story I'm reporting out, a lot of feminist theory, a lot of critical race theory in recent weeks. And it's very interesting how they really insist on what I call the progressive or bigot binary. So you're either sufficiently progressive, and that means you have to agree with absolutely every single aspect of the progressive doctrine, or you're a bigot. And that's what's remarkable, is that people could come out and say a letter signed by Noam Chomsky and Gloria Steinem was guilty of bigotry or perpetuating bigotry. And it's because you are either one or the other. They shove everybody into one of those two categories because they've expanded the definitions of bigotry, frankly, to that degree. And that comes out of academia. You know, we had a couple of generations of students who were funneled increasingly into higher education, and now they're out in the working world, and they're shaping those conversations in newsrooms and boardrooms. And that's where we see that this kind of very radical idea being mainstreamed and normalized in powerful institutions.
You said just a moment ago that the ideas expressed in this Harper's letter only a few years ago would not have been considered controversial in most newsrooms. What has changed, Emily?
Right. And that is the real question. I think what changed is that these are ideas you would hear in the classroom. Professors have been assigning Judith Butler and books for decades, and those are some feminist thinkers who would insist on this kind of progressive or bigot binary through their work. And so I think what we've seen is the point of critical mass was hit in the so-called real world. So it's snowballed to a point where now there are enough people who either agree with those ideas because they absorbed them either wittingly or through osmosis in academia and then brought them into the real world, or because they're frankly so intimidated by that formulation that you're either progressive or bigot, and it's easier for them to go in one direction than the other. And so I think we've hit the point of critical mass, and I think that explains this head-spinning series of weeks that we've had this late spring and early summer, where, you know, everything seems to be under attack.
What does this left-on-left infighting tell you about the so-called progressives?
It's interesting because there's a real clash between someone, again, I keep going back to Noam Chomsky and Gloria Steinem, some of these, you know, leftists who are clashing with the notion that open debate should be the definition of open debate. You know, we should narrow those boundaries to an almost impossible space. It's interesting that this sort of like traditional American leftism is clashing with, you know, millennial progressivism. And I think what it gets to is that, you know, the left really used to be very different. They used to, you know, complain about and mock conservatives who wanted to get TV shows taken off the air for being indecent. They used to be the people who were out there defending the principle of the marketplace of ideas and saying this is how we get to truth is through debate. And so the fact that there's a clash, I think, means that there's a new left that's transforming right before our eyes as we speak in this moment, because it's changed. It's completely changed from what it used to be.
The ultimate Washington insider, he served multiple presidential administrations, Robert Reich, declined to sign the Harper letter, and I quote, "Because Trumpism, racism, xenophobia, and sexism have had such free rein and baleful influence in recent years that we should honor and respect the expressions of anger and heartache finally being heard. What does his reasoning tell you?
Well, so that's very, very interesting because he's essentially saying this is not reasoning. It's sort of visceral anger and heartache, which is very different. And you know, maybe he would say those are the same things. But I would say him not endorsing the concept of open debate because we should listen, you know, contrasting it with anger and heartache. He's saying one is reason and one is emotion, which I think is, it wasn't intended to, but I do think it actually undercuts the anger and the heartache that he's referencing because I think he's accurately describing it as visceral more than rational. But it is fascinating that somebody who is the ultimate Washington insider would, you know, in earlier years, that would be, you'd be ashamed. But instead, it's incentivized to have a position like that in some circles. So it is, it's truly remarkable that someone, as you say, that is really the ultimate Washington insider would be comfortable coming out with a statement like that.
Does he kind of prove the point of those who did sign the letter by making that statement?
Yeah, in a way, by making that, drawing that contrast between reason and emotion, as I think he did unintentionally, yes, because the people who are reaffirming their commitment to open debate are saying, you know, we've gotten so far away from reason, and we are listening so much to emotion, and we're prizing it over reason, and that is the problem. And in a way, I do think he actually does kind of, in his own unintentional way, confirm that.
You write, some observers mocked the letter as a claim to victimhood from people who have no right to it, people with major platforms complaining about restrictions at major platforms. What do you make of that criticism, Emily?
You know, those critics are absolutely right, that these are people largely in positions of power and privilege, and that's why I think the letter is important, because they are powerful people, and they are saying, hey, this is an important principle, and we're going to stand up for it. But it's funny, because we've seen people of power and privilege. I mean, a Boeing executive was forced to resign just last week after people dug up a 30-year-old op-ed in which he wrote that women shouldn't serve in combat roles. Talk about power. That man had power, and he's now been forced to resign. And so they may see that as just another casualty of their culture war that they've been waging. But, you know, what it actually is setting precedents and normalizing that kind of behavior. So it's absolutely true these people are powerful and that they're privileged. But they're not really claiming to be victims. And by the way, I guarantee you almost every single one of those people has self-censored beyond the boundaries of healthy self-censorship. We all should self-censor in a way because everything that comes into our head probably shouldn't go out into the public square. But, you know, some of these things, like transgenderism is a really good example. Kids' lives are on the line, frankly, and people who are proposing a radical new concept of gender absolutely need to stand up to scrutiny of open debate on something like hormone therapy. It's just something that needs to have an honest and open public conversation about. And, you know, there has to be a way to do it. There has to be a way to do it while protecting people, and not having the conversation is not the answer.
New York Times columnist Michelle Goldberg signed the Harper's letter. Why do you think that's significant?
I really think it's very amusing that Michelle, I think it's very telling. And this is why Michelle Goldberg is the reason I say this letter could be a bulwark or a death rattle, because Michelle Goldberg was among the people who lent her support to the idea that Tom Cotton should not have been published by the op-ed pages of the New York Times for which she works. She kind of punted on the question, but she wrote a column basically saying, she called Tom Cotton, who wrote an op-ed about the military controlling protests and riots, really, she called him a proto-fascist, that his ideas were proto-fascist. And, you know, his position was a mainstream conservative position. So Michelle Goldberg signs this letter supporting open debate, but won't publish mainstream conservatism in her own paper. It's fascinating, because who else said they support the concept of open debate? The people who chose not to sign the letter and wrote the counter letter. And so I do question the follow through of some of the signers, not all of them. I don't think Noam Chomsky is going to be trying to cancel or censor himself. I don't think, you know, Barry Weiss is. I don't think some of these people are. But I do question, you know, when push comes to shove, will you actually support the correct concept of open debate? Or do you support open debate in name only and actually really believe in this very narrow leftist concept of it?
So at this point, do you think the Harper's letter is a sign that some in the left are really seeing the danger of cancel culture to the free exchange of ideas and really to American institutions?
Absolutely. I think I detected a rightful hint of panic in that letter. I think if you look at what some people on the left are organizing right now in terms of trying to support or create institutions that promote open debate and promote free speech, I think there's a sudden panic because these last few weeks really have been head spinning. We have statues of abolitionists being toppled by demonstrators and who are protesting, they say, in favor of racial justice. So it's counterproductive. It does not make sense. It is incoherent. It is illiberal, and it is a serious threat. And it's about to consume American culture. I mean, it's really getting close. And so, yes, I detected a hint of panic, really, in the Harper's letter and in other efforts that I've seen. Now, of course, they should have recognized this threat years ago. And Matthew Iglesias of Vox, he's a co-founder of Vox, he tweeted something to that extent a few weeks ago saying, you know, I probably should take back essentially some of my mockery of conservative criticism of college campuses. You know, this has been happening for a long time, and some of us have been shouting it from the rooftops and getting ignored and told, you know, wait till they get into the real world. This is just abstract campus dorm room debating. Well, no, that's of course not what it turned out to be. So I think reality is hitting some of these people really hard right now in this difficult moment.
Emily Jashinsky is culture editor at The Federalist and author of a recent column there titled "The Harper's Letter Will Be a Bulwark or a Death Rattle." You can read her columns at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Talk On Demand Archives. Emily, thank you so much.
Thank you.
When we come back, Joy Pullman will be with us. We're going to talk about federal funding for schools that fail to open. Stay tuned. What is God calling you to do? What is the one thing you were born to do? Are you truly doing what you're called to do? The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for July is Callings for Life, God's Plan, Your Purpose. It's published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040, or learn more about Callings for Life at issuesetc.org. The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for July, Callings for Life, God's Plan, Your Purpose.
The Simply Classical curriculum for special needs moves at my child's pace and gives her exactly what she needs. So writes Amber, a homeschooling mother who has joined thousands in homes and schools teaching from this uniquely Christian classical approach to special education. Teach students with autism, learning disabilities, or Down syndrome based on ability level rather than chronological age. Use promo code LPR20 today at classicalspecialneeds.com. Classicalspecialneeds.com.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Have you ever wondered if your investments could do more? I mean, a whole lot more? This is Rahema Kavuga, Synod Relations Manager of Lutheran Church Extension Fund. When you invest with us, you not only earn a competitive interest rate, but your investment goes to strengthen Lutheran Church Missouri Synod church workers, congregations, schools, and organizations through low-cost loans and services. To learn more, visit lcef.org/invest101.
Your church's chrismons are from the 80s. They're made of styrofoam, their glitter is shedding, and they're held together with toothpicks. Now is the perfect time to replace them with AdChristmas Christmas in July sale. Participating artists have discounted their products, so stock up on jewelry, crucifixes, art, church banners, music, greeting cards, and more. Discounts range from 10 to 50% off. Visit us at adcrucem.com to take advantage of the sale. That's ADCRUCEM.com.